Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
All right. Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, and I'll be one of your hosts today. Today, we have a Q&A episode from our listeners. We love these episodes because we love your questions. For all your listeners who have not submitted your favorite question, please submit it because we will answer it on a future episode. Today, we have as our panelist, Barbara Freeberg. How are you doing today, Barb?
Doing great, Kirk. How are you?
I'm doing great. And we also have Miranda Marquette. How are you doing today, Miranda?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm getting over illness, so pardon my voice if it sounds whatever.
Well, that's okay. You can keep the party started. Prior to the show, Miranda was... There we go. Miranda was DJing prior to the episode, and we're hoping to bring that here for a little bit of fun. So let's get this episode started on the right foot. So the first listener question is from Chinita. I am new to your podcast and investing, and I heard Miranda say on one of the podcasts that she has 1 month worth of money in a regular savings account, and she has the rest in a long-term investment account. I was wondering which long-term investment she was referring to exactly. I'm assuming it was not her 401k, and she made a mention of it to that regard. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, this is a great question. Thanks for asking it. So I'm one of those folks who has a relatively high tolerance for certain types of risk. One of those is that I do, in fact, keep about four, sometimes six, up to 6 weeks, it depends, but 4 to 6 weeks worth of expenses in a high yield savings account. And then I keep the rest of my emergency fund in a taxable investment account. So it's just like a regular taxable investment account. I personally keep mine at Betterment. You can keep yours wherever you want, but I keep mine at Betterment. And it is just a 50-50 split between stock index ETFs and bond index ETFs. And it's just a way for the money to kind of grow at a faster pace. I actually talked about this with Business Insider not too long ago and actually posted on MirandaMarquette.com how I manage it and how I built it. So if you want to go to MirandaMarquette.com, you can actually find a post that I recently wrote about how I do my emergency savings. You can see how I built it up to that point. You can see where I put it and how I manage it and kind of how I make it work. Now, you do have to have a strong stomach for this. Right now, everybody feels like an investment genius because we've had our longest bull run in history. So we all feel like I'm an investment genius because my portfolio is doing great. Well, everybody's portfolio is doing great. The real test of this is, can you stomach it when you have a down market? And I did, in fact, in 2010, have to sell some of my investments at a loss to pay for a flooded basement. So that was kind of a bummer that I had to sell at a loss. But at the same time, I had the capital available to me. It did not wipe out my account. So I still had money in the account afterward. And I was able to deduct those losses on my taxes. So you really have to get clear about the purpose of it, right? So I keep it in a taxable investment account. And when I need the capital, when I need the money, it's there. I can liquidate the assets. And it works for me. Different people are going to have different levels. I think, Barb, you are on the other side of this. So, Barb, share your thoughts.
Yes, I am definitely on the other side of this because I don't have a big stomach for risk. Although I've been investing for many, many decades, I've been in the markets, I am a very conservative investor. And what this means is I like to know that I have 6 months to a year of my expenses in cash. And again, this is just me. And it's sitting in a high yield savings account. I'm earning close to 2%. And actually, just another plug for Betterment, they do have a high yield cash account as well if you want to use them or another robo advisor. But I like to know that if my investments tank, if my stock investment portion of my portfolio happens to go down 10, 15, 20, 30% like it did in 2007 or 2008, then that's fine. I don't need to liquidate anything. And I actually have cash to put into the markets at that time. So this is totally a personal issue. There is not a right or wrong answer to this. This all depends on how much money you have, how comfortable you are in seeing the losses in your portfolio after a stock market drop. And those are infrequent, but they do happen periodically.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that, as she said, I do keep this separate from my retirement account. I know how much I need to put in my retirement account each month to reach my own retirement portfolio goals, and this money is separate from that. As she pointed out, I am not using a tax-advantaged retirement account as my emergency fund.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really good point, Miranda, because if you contribute as much as you possibly can to your retirement account, I suggest really maxing it out till it hurts, then the rest of your money, you know your retirement will be secure. And if you need to dip into your other accounts for an emergency, well, you know you're not going to shoot yourself in the foot and kill your retirement savings.
I love this perspective, and I actually have a different perspective because I think it's something that's important to consider. So if you think back like a few decades ago, a lot of people were more focused on cash and saving cash, and now we're a very credit-based economy. You know, if you kind of think about some of the opportunities and the opportunity cost, I think everybody should have some cash, an emergency fund, because that's just the way I was raised. I think that's important. But, you know, a lot of people say, well, you should have 6 months or a year in an emergency fund. And with interest rates at next to 0%, or hopefully they don't go into the negative territory, but with interest rates at such a low period, it almost makes no sense to keep cash. Now, this has nothing to do with opportunity cost, as Barbara was mentioning, because certainly having cash when the market goes down is a great advantage. But just strictly for cash that you're keeping for emergencies, you also might want to consider getting a home equity line if you own your home. Now, I don't subscribe to the fact that you should use it. I think it's an emergency. You use it for emergencies. But if you think about it, it doesn't cost you any money to set up a home equity line on your home. You have access to the funds if you need it. If you try to do this when you lose your job, you will not be able to get it because it's going to require you have an income. So I recommend to everybody that they get one, even if they never use it, so that they have the optionality to use it as need be. Some people never use it, and that's great. But at least it's there. It's like having a credit card that you don't use for emergencies. It's the same kind of principle. But with a home equity line, you can at least draw cash for things that you need cash for as opposed to a credit card. It's just another option. You know, if you don't feel comfortable keeping 6 months worth of cash or just cash sitting in an account, you can consider using a home equity line as the emergency fund and maybe keep like 1 or 2 months cash or whatever you feel comfortable with in that way. So it's just another option. I'm certainly not a huge fan of it, but I think given the fact that there's low interest rates, it makes it more viable. And especially if there are negative interest rates, it's even more appealing. So just my thoughts on it. But actually, since we're touching on the topic of budgets, it gets into our next listener question. So the next listener question is from Justin. I don't have a formal budget that I follow. I don't track every single purchase that I make, but I do mentally moderate how much I spend, and I know I make more than I spend. I don't have any debt other than my mortgage. I have an emergency fund, and I'm on track with saving and investing for retirement. Considering all of this, do I still need to follow a formal budget? Thanks, as always. Great show. So, Miranda, what are your thoughts on this?
Nope. I mean, that's the thing, right? A budget is really great when you are, you know, working on goals like figuring out how to get out of debt, how to start building up that savings. And it's always good to know where your money is going and have an idea of that. But I do not have a formal budget either. What I have is kind of a spending plan based on my priorities. And so I actually have, and it sounds like you might have a similar deal, but I basically have automated stuff, right? So every month, automatically, money goes to my tax-advantaged retirement account, goes to my long-term emergency, goes to charity. I actually have my charitable donations automatically set up. Goes to my son's 529, goes to the insurance, goes to, like, all of those things are automatically deducted. It's all automatic. The only thing that isn't automatic are the groceries that I have to buy, you know? And so all of those things, the things that matter the most, you know, contributions to my travel fund. All of those things are automated and taken care of very first. And because those things are covered, my priorities are covered, what I want to do with my money is taken care of, having a personal budget for every other little thing doesn't matter. Because the big things are covered. It's like that overused analogy, right? With the rocks and the jar, you know, you put the big rocks in the jar and then you can pour it, the sand can fill it in. It's the same kind of thing. So yes, all the big stuff is covered. The most important things are covered. So whatever's left, it doesn't matter where I spend. It doesn't matter whether it's entertainment versus dining out versus putting extra money in my travel fund or going somewhere with my son for the weekend. It doesn't matter because the big stuff is covered and I have enough money left over to do other things. So I kind of like to joke that once the big stuff is covered, then I just spend till it's gone. And every couple of months, every quarter or so, I sit down and I review my past spending and I look through everything and just kind of take a look at like, oh, am I starting to spend money on things I don't care about? And if that's the case, then I just adjust my spending to make sure that I'm focused on the things that matter to me.
Nice. What about you, Barb? You probably, I imagine, have a little different approach. What's your approach to this?
No, I do not have a different approach. This is the one time Miranda and I are totally on target.
We agree.
Right. We agree 100%. Having a budget is a personal decision. Everyone does not need a budget. When I was younger, I had a budget because even though I automated my retirement savings, so that has always been taken care of, we didn't have a lot of money. There were periods where we were really, really tight on money when at the beginning of our marriage. And so I had that budget because I wanted to know if our restaurant spending was over 50 bucks, you know, 50 bucks over in a month. I needed to know that. But at the present time, like Miranda, I don't have a budget. I've reached my retirement goal, so I'm one of the lucky ones. Or as we could say, on the other hand, I'm old. And so when you do get older, you know, you tend to reach your goals. But once you automate the things that are really important, you're saving for retirement, you're saving for a house, you're saving for your kids' college, your travel fund, your regular bills, then yeah, spend the rest. It just doesn't matter. It's a personal preference. Some people like a budget just to feel like they have control and they can see where every dollar goes. Other people, you don't need to do that as long as you are making sure to take care of those really, really important bills every month.
Yeah, thanks, Barb. We haven't had an episode on budgeting in a while, and I think that maybe we'll interview some people from some of the technology providers because there are some good technology solutions. I've got a lot of clients requesting this recently and on helping them devise a strategy with their budget. And, you know, like Miranda and Barb said, it's really a personal thing. I think one of the challenges is it's the dreaded B word that nobody wants to talk about. And it's hard and it's basically putting a restriction on your lifestyle and having fun. And nobody wants to do that. But there are some ways to set it up so that it's systematically done well. And, you know, some of us have challenges in this area. I'd say a lot of us do in terms of structuring. Some people put everything in one account. You know, if they're married, sometimes that's a challenge because they have two people dipping into the same account and not everybody has the same capability to manage money well in their cash flows. So there's usually one person's pretty conservative and one's not so much, and that presents challenges. So it's coming up with good systems to put them in place to help offset some of the weaker areas that people have. And that might be setting up multiple accounts. It might be setting up automation or maybe even going through a budget together. But I think it's a good process to go through if you're married to have those conversations so that you're on the same page. Even if you don't have the same style or the same opinion about money, at least having the conversations allows you to have a more unified approach in terms of what you need to do. I think we'll probably bring somebody on to talk about some best practices in the future because I think it is an important concept to talk about. So the next question, and by the way, if you want to ask your questions, if your listeners, you want to ask your own questions, you can just email us at contact@moneytreepodcast.com. That's contact@moneytreepodcast.com. So the next question is from Luther. Luther's very brief. He says, how do I evaluate REITs? Let's talk to our portfolio management expert, Barb. What are your thoughts on this?
First off, let me tell you what a REIT is. For those of you who don't know, it is called a real estate investment trust. And this type of investment is like a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund. And the fund owns many, many, many different types of real estate companies. And these REITs come in a variety, many different varieties, from a kind of general REIT, which will cover all different types of real estate investing. And then we've got some that cover different sectors, such as office REITs, industrial REITs, retail, lodging, residential. My personal, I own REITs. I own a general REIT because I just like to cover the whole real estate market in one fell swoop. There are many, many, many to choose from. The way I evaluate them is very, very simply. For the most simple way to invest in a real estate investment trust is look at the fees. Lower fees are better. And look at the breadth of the investments. Vanguard has some very good REITs that are low fee, and they cover the entire real estate market. That's how I evaluate it. It's not rocket science. It's really simple. If you want to get into a little niche REIT investing, I suggest you go to REIT.com, REIT.com. Look at their sectors. You'll learn a little bit about them. The self-storage REIT sector is really big now. And then you can just go and look at the variety of different REITs that are available. I always look at expenses because the lower your expenses, the more money that you are investing goes into the actual investment. That's what I would suggest.
Great. So Miranda, DJ Miranda, what are your thoughts on this? How do you evaluate REITs?
I like REITs as well. It's how I get real estate exposure in my portfolio. And honestly, I just kind of look at REITs in terms of different sectors that I think might be doing well. So, you know, I actually have quite a few, well, not quite a few, but I have a healthcare REIT that includes healthcare properties, you know, like hospitals, assisted living facilities, you know, those kinds of things, because we have an aging population. You know, I don't have anything really formalized about it. REITs don't make up a huge percentage of my portfolio. So it's one of those things where I'm like, I'm going to go with my gut a little bit. So yeah, so I have a healthcare REIT. I also have some storage REITs, right, that focus on personal storage properties where people can store their things. So basically, I just kind of look at, you know, what are some of the needs that are coming up in and what kind of trends can we expect? And then I just kind of go from there. Nothing really special, nothing really technical. If you are going to start investing in REITs, you should listen to Barb and not me.
Yeah, I think REITs are one of those categories that it's a little bit different from looking at the economics of a traditional stock because they're, you know, the financials are, you know, a little bit different. We're talking about real estate, they're using leverage. There's a lot of different aspects to it that are different from, like, say, a typical company that you might find in the S&P 500. You know, I think the way that we look at it is, to keep this short, because there's obviously longer explanations to this, but effectively, if you look at REITs, they're very interest rate sensitive. So if you're looking at any real estate, it's going to be tied to the trends in real estate as Miranda said, like the trends are important. Is this part of the real estate sector trending well? If it's not, then you want to be careful. But you know, you want to make sure that it's trending in the right direction. You want to make sure that it's going to be tied to interest rates. So if interest rates are low as they are now, then the yield on REITs will be lower than if we had higher interest rates. So there is some correlation there because institutional investors are looking at this too. And they're thinking to themselves like, well, I could invest my money into a bond, a corporate bond, or I could buy a REIT and get a few extra percentage points on that. So they will look for REITs as an opportunity to get a better yield or better income stream. Well, you can look at the REITs in a fundamental analysis, you know, looking through all the numbers and comparing them to other REITs. At the end of the day, the institutions drive the prices because they're the ones with the biggest amount of money. So they tend to drive equity prices one way or the other. So just keep in mind that that is one of the fundamental drivers of stock prices are the institutional investors. So you need to be aware of how they're looking at in these investments. There are plenty of fundamental investors there, but in many ways, they're also looking at it the way Barb and Miranda are looking at it. And they're also tying it to interest rates. So just something to keep in mind when you're looking at REITs. We actually have a guest coming on in the next few weeks who has a REIT with a little extra tax benefit to it, which is going to be a really interesting interview. Excited to have him on. So let's see. The next question is from Paul. Paul's question is quite long, so I will try to distill it down into a shorter question. But effectively, what Paul is asking is he's asking, there are a lot of ways to look at asset allocation. There are many different models. There are many different papers. Everyone has their own opinion. No two experts agree. And he's looking to find some, as he calls them, universal truths. So he's commenting because of our guest, Ameb Faber from Cambria Investment Management, when he came on to talk about asset allocation. And Ameb actually has a lot of great resources on his website talking about asset allocation models. He does, I think he's got an ETF called the Trinity approach, but it's effectively just looking at how you allocate assets, because as a lot of people will say, that most of your return is derived from the asset allocation. So he wants to know what's the best approach to look at asset allocation. Barb, what are your thoughts on this?
This question actually gets back to our initial discussion about risk. There are two fundamental principles. One is that historically, the stock market has higher returns. So over the past 80 to 100 years, an all U.S. stock market portfolio would have returned 9 or 10%. On the other hand, bonds have lower returns and less risk. And in this sense, we're talking about risk as volatility, which means the up and down of prices. And so over history, bonds have returned less. 5 or 4% historically, although now they're a little bit lower. The reason stocks return greater amounts than bonds historically is because they are more volatile, more ups and downs. So how do you determine your asset allocation? It always starts with how much risk you can tolerate. If you're like Miranda and you really have your emergency needs taken care of, you're young-ish, you can tolerate the ups and downs of the stock market. If the stock market drops 30% in a year, it's not going to make much of a difference to your long-term investing because you're investing for the long term. Then in that case, you're going to own a greater percentage of stock type investments. There are experts that say if you're in your 30s or 40s, you can own up to 80 or 90% of stocks in your investment portfolio. And then if you do not like the volatility of seeing your investment values go down, regardless of your age, then you would be considered a more conservative investor. And you want to hold a greater proportion of bond-type investments in your portfolio. So you might have a 40% bond, 60% stock market allocation. And that's the main driver of how you want to allocate your portfolio. And then I'm going to drone on for just one more second and give you a couple resources that can help you a little bit with this. And that is Portfolio Visualizer is a website that can help you see potential risks and rewards of different asset allocations. Then there's another website on MarketWatch called Lazy Portfolios, which gives you about, five or so different asset allocation portfolios and how they have done.
Great. Thanks a lot, Barb. Miranda, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I think Barb pretty well covered it. I mean, asset allocation really depends on where you're at. You know, I talk about in my emergency fund, I have like a 50-50 stock bond split for ETFs. My travel fund actually has a different, it's actually more aggressive than my emergency fund. It's closer to a 70-30 stock bonds ETF split, index ETF split. So it really kind of depends on what you're trying to accomplish, how much risk tolerance you have, I like to see that more rapid growth in my travel fund. I like to have more bonds in my emergency fund because I do want that illusion of stability. So it just sort of depends on where you're at. And then, of course, as Barb pointed out, I'm relatively young. For my actual tax-advantaged retirement accounts, I've got more of a 90-10 stock bond split because it's very, very aggressive because I won't be accessing it for a while. But of course, as I move closer to retirement, we'll probably start shifting that asset allocation. So it really depends on where your risk tolerance is, what you're using the money for, and where you're comfortable.
Yeah, that's great. I want to bring a different lens to this because I've been doing a lot of research on this for a long time. I know that most of the models that people use historical data, and well, they all do, but the historical data kind of brings in a few different concepts that I think people should be aware of. And not saying you should ignore what people are saying, I'm just saying that you need to be aware of it because these things impact ultimately what your return is going to be. So historically, you know, the thesis is between 80 and 90% of your returns are based off the asset allocation, or some, you know, it's like 95% or some crazy number. You know, I looked into that and I understand why that comes up. But if you really look at the historical numbers, which is what this is based on, we've had a bond bull market for 40 years now, and it's a really long running bull market in bonds. As far as I know, people thought it was over up until they lowered interest rates again. But effectively, you have this dynamic that will skew the results. Because if you look at like from the 80s and 90s, you would have said, oh, equities, they just keep going up. Let's put all our money in equities. Because history would show that equities continue to go up. Or the real estate market up until 2005. Well, real estate always goes up. So you should put your money in real estate. And I think we always have to assess our assumptions on what we're doing. So for an example, if you look at asset allocation in 2008, asset allocation was useless. Unless you were in cash or gold, you pretty much lost 38%, somewhere thereabouts, because that's what the index did. And almost everything got the same return. Another good example is Q4 of last year. There weren't a lot of safety nets if you were allocating your assets last year. And I think the challenge in these markets is if the markets are operating normally, asset allocation is a great tool to manage risk. And to really what it does is it manages your, I hate to say this, your ineptitude. If you listen to like a Warren Buffett or like Carl Icahn or some of these people who are really good at managing money, they put all their assets in a handful of investments and they really spend a lot of time with those investments. Now, they're taking a lot more risk, but they're willing to take that risk because they're the smartest people in the room, arguably. So if anybody's going to know that investment better than others, it'd probably be them. And they're willing to take that risk. I think for most of us, you know, myself included, we're not necessarily the smartest people in the room. We don't have all the information that these other people have. You know, I don't sit here looking at Google Maps and assessing how many trucks go in and out of this storage facility. And these are what these institutional investors do, is they use their extensive resources to get all the data they can to make good decisions. You and I and Barb and Miranda, we don't have those kind of resources to do that, or willingness, quite frankly. That's who you're competing against. So if you're thinking about it from that concept, it's better to diversify and to have a diversified portfolio into different assets because we can't know the future. That being said, you just have to be aware that asset allocation works when the markets go up, and when the markets melt down like 2008 or Q4 last year, it doesn't work as intended always. So you shouldn't take comfort in the fact that diversification will save you, because it may or it may not. You need to keep in mind that risk management goes beyond just diversification. And this is a more of a newer concept because the markets have changed. So while using rules of thumb is a good idea, you should still keep in mind that you need to be thoughtful about your approach and how you're allocating. People like Meb Faber do a great job at putting together these models based on data. And, you know, Ray Dalio talks about his all-weather fund occasionally. So there are good resources out there to look for asset allocation. But just be aware there is no silver bullet. And just using the rule of thumb doesn't give you the license to stop thinking. You need to be aware of where your money's going, and you need to be mindful that there is no silver bullet that's going to solve your problems. You just need to be a better and more knowledgeable investor. So Last question comes from Kirk. Why do mutual funds always mimic or underperform the index, even though they should be outperforming? Barb, what are your thoughts on this?
Okay, first of all, I don't agree with the assumption that all mutual funds mimic or underperform the index. First of all, mutual funds, like exchange-traded funds, are groups of different assets, be they stocks, bonds, combination, all different sorts of assets. There are tons of different styles of mutual funds, from index mutual funds, which copy the stocks or bonds owned in a particular index. For example, an S&P 500 index mutual fund will own the same stocks that are in that index. As you would expect, their returns will be very close to the returns of that index. They will underperform by a small amount, and the amount is usually equal to the amount of the expense ratio, which is the management fee on the fund. So that's very clear cut. Actively managed mutual funds have a manager at the helm, and they buy and sell different types of stocks in order to attempt to beat the returns of an index. Now, many of these actively managed funds have a habit of secretly copying owning the stocks within the index because they don't want to underperform them. Okay, that's one known fact. Then others of these actively managed index funds will, in fact, perform better than a comparable index, and others will underperform based on the investment choices they make. So when you're looking to buy a mutual fund, look at what the individual investments are within that fund. Is it an index fund? What is the expense ratio? Is it an actively managed fund? What are the investments within that fund? And although you can look at past performance, that's not going to tell you how it's going to perform in the future. But the important thing when choosing a fund is figure out what your own goal is and then invest according to your goal. Just as a side note, the majority of funds, both mutual and exchange traded funds, fail to outperform the indexes. Okay, hope that helps.
No, it does. Thanks for your input, Barb. I think it's very helpful. I want to touch on it a little bit too, but Miranda, what are your thoughts on this?
So personally, to me, it's all about like, what are your goals? And like, do you really need to beat the index? Like, do you need to really need to outperform the market to reach your goals? I don't, so I don't care. I don't care whether I'm outperforming the market. Sometimes my portfolio does outperform the market just because of, you know, maybe my asset allocation, those REITs might give it a little boost. But for the most part, you know, I mean, if you're following an index fund, it's not going to outperform the market, even if it's not actively managed, because you're going to have the fees, right? You're going to have the fees, you're going to have the expense ratios, all of that stuff is going to come out against it. And it's just not the same. It's just not the same as picking stocks or being involved. And personally, I don't need to outperform the market. I don't feel the need to beat an index fund, to beat the index with my funds. I'm okay with it not keeping, you know, because it keeps pace with gains, it keeps pace with how it goes, and it helps me reach my personal goals. So it's enough. It's enough to do what I want to do. So I don't really care.
I think it's a great point you make, Miranda, about the mindset piece, which I think it's, you know, it really just comes down to FOMO, right? Is that people look at their portfolios and they say, well, I underperform the index. Like, what's wrong? Or, you know, I need to beat the index. And they feel this need to one-up other people or to keep up with other people. And I always advise people, don't tell anybody what you're investing in, because you're just going to get into this game of like, who's better? And, you know, it's like going to the casino. How many times have you gone to the casino and you've come back with money and you brag, hey, I just won $1,000 at the casino. But when you lose money at the casino, how many people did you tell? There's this game of FOMO is really kind of a false game, because people talk about their winners and they never talk about their losers. And so clients come to me once in a while and they're like, hey, you know, why are we not in this? I'm like, well, because that investment's really stupid. Like, your friend happened to make money because they were lucky. you can invest in it, but it's just, it's not a good idea. We can do that, but I wouldn't put a lot of money in it because it's not a good idea. And then, you know, and then the friend loses money and the friend never talks about it. They say, oh yeah, I got out of that investment or whatever they say, but it's not really a true vision of what other people are doing. So it's better just to stay out of that conversation altogether and just not talk about how you're investing to other people. Because you don't want to get into that game of, you know, who's better or trying to outperform the index, which, you know, generally speaking, the whole point of the index is it is the market. So you should be performing similar to the index. That's fine if that's your goal. If it's not your goal, then you shouldn't be comparing it. So if your goal is to make 3% a year, you should not be comparing your performance to the S&P 500. I know people do that all the time. But just it's just you need to find a comparison point, whether it's a fixed amount, just say, hey, I want to make 3% a year, or I want to perform similar to the index, whatever it might be, that should be your goal. It shouldn't be, I want to beat the index. And I wanted to bring up this one point of career risk, which I talked about in a prior podcast, but one of the main reasons why mutual fund managers underperform their comparative index is because the incentives are not aligned. The incentives for a portfolio manager are not great if they outperform the index. They might get a little bit of a bonus, but if they significantly underperform the index, they get fired. Well, to me, if I'm a portfolio manager, that's not a great incentive for me to do great work. If I want to take a lot of risk and get good performance, I want to get compensated. But if it means that if I miss the ball and underperform significantly, I get fired, that's not a great incentive. So, you know, as a portfolio manager, I know a bunch of them who do this. As Barb said, they will mimic the index by, in some cases, buying an index. Let's say your comparative index is the S&P 500. They will actually buy shares of the ETF, the SPY, to put in their fund so that they can be similar to the index, and then they'll trade around it. And it's kind of like a core satellite model where the core is the index and you trade around it to try to get a little bit extra return here and there. But ultimately, the drag is always going to be their fees. So even if they get the exact same return as the index, it's still going to be less due to the fees. There's a lot of reasons that they underperform. And you have people like Warren Buffett out there who talk about this from time to time, who just say, I'll bet anybody over a 10-year period that you underperform the index. And he's had some famous bets with some really, really smart hedge fund managers, and they've taken the bet and they've lost. And Warren's not smart. You know, he's obviously a smart guy, but he's not smart enough to know what the performance of this manager is going to be. He just knows statistically he'd rather invest in the index than bet on somebody that's trying to beat the index. So I think people feel the need to do that, but I think it's just from a mindset perspective, people should just be aware that that mindset is going to send you down the wrong rabbit holes, and you can get yourself into trouble if you don't understand why you're investing. So that's it for this week's Q&A. Thank you all for listening to the show. Miranda, Barb, thanks for coming on. Barb, where can people find more about you?
People can find more about me at Robo Advisor Pros, where I help individuals learn about how to invest with less stress.
And Miranda, where can people find more about you?
Yeah, head on over to MirandaMarkwit.com. I have a resources section with a bunch of resources that help me manage my money. And you can see how I do that. And then also, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, there is a relatively recent post. You can see how I manage my emergency funds. So you can get a little more in-depth explanation of that.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes for all your listeners. You can go to the website, moneytreepodcast.com, and you can get a link to Miranda's post. So that's it for the show. My name's Kirk Chisholm. I'm a wealth manager at Innovate Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. Of course, you can always find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to the resources, show notes, archive shows as well. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comments on the podcast app of your choice. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.